Job thinks he's dying. He's sitting on an ash heap, wasted away to nearly nothing. He doesn't know what we know, that there's a story going on behind the scenes, that God is using Job to defeat Satan. After all, Satan has said that the only reason people like Job even follow God is because God blesses them. But Satan said, God, the moment you stop blessing them and allow suffering and hardship to come in their life, people like Job will stop following you. That's what Satan said to God. And God said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in all the earth? You see, we know this. We know the conversation. We know what's going on behind the scenes, but Job doesn't know any of this. All that he knows is that he is experiencing the greatest pain and heartache of his life. In fact, way back in Job chapter 3, would you hold your place there in chapter 11 and flip over to chapter 3? I want to remind you what Job said of what he's experiencing. Job chapter 3, look at verse number 25, if you will. Job 3, 25, Job says, the thing which I greatly feared has come upon me. The thing that I feared the most, the thing that I was most afraid of. And we looked at that verse not long ago and even posed the question, what are you most afraid of? What is the greatest fear that you have happening to you? Well, Job says, that which I was most afraid of, that which I greatly feared more than anything else, it has happened to me. And we know he lost everything. He lost his children. He lost his wealth, possessions, and now it appears he's losing his health. And additionally, he's surrounded by these so-called friends who are of no help or value to him. There are no blessing, no encouragement to this great tragedy taking place in his life. And each one of them have had something to say. Eliphaz, Bildad, and now we get to the third friend. His name is Zophar. Zophar is the one who speaks up next. You'll find him talking in chapter 11. So if you'll go back to chapter 11, we're going to look at a few things here about Zophar. Zophar appears to be the youngest of the three friends, and I think it shows here, because he's a know-it-all. He's a young buck who thinks he knows everything. He's quick to answer. He's dogmatic in his positions. Now, when you look at Zophar and some of the things that he's saying, he does say some things that are right, but he lacks a great deal of discernment, especially regarding the situation that Job finds himself to be in. And though he may say some things that are true and a few things that may be indeed right, he's saying these things in the wrong spirit. In fact, he's very harsh toward Job rather than being helpful to Job. He's condemning rather than comforting. He is belittling instead of bearing his burden. In fact, you look at these verses with me here in chapter 11. Zophar makes three accusations against Job. You can find these in your notes. I don't think they're on the screen, but perhaps you'd like to write them down on your handout there in front of you. Number one, the first thing that Zophar says to Job is, Job, you are guilty of sin. That's your problem, Job. That's why you're in this situation that you're in. You're guilty. And you're guilty of sin, Job. Look at verse number 1, chapter 11. Then answered Zophar, the Naamathite, and said, should not the multitude of words be answered? He's talking about Job talking so much. Should not all this that you're saying be answered? Should a man full of talk be justified? Then he gets downright ugly. Look at verse 3. Should thy lies make men hold their peace? In other words, all these things that you're lying about, should we just sit here and be quiet about it? Look at it again, verse 3. When thou mockest, shall no man make thee ashamed? For thou hast said, Job, that your doctrine is pure and that you're clean in your eyes. Oh, Job, but oh, that God would actually speak and open his lips against thee. And that he would show thee the secrets of wisdom, that they are double to that which is. Know therefore that God exacteth of thee less than thine iniquity deserveth. Can you believe this? Eliphaz has said his deal. Bildad said his deal. The very first thing that Zophar says is, Job, you're a liar. Now, what's he accusing Job of lying about? How that there's no sin that has caused his suffering. How that he's trusting God and he's putting faith in God. And yes, there's days he's on the mountain and there's days in his valley. But he knows God has a plan and he's trusting him. And that there's no sin in his life that has brought this upon him. And Zophar says, you're a liar, Job. And we're not going to sit here and hold our peace while you continue to say these things that are untrue. In fact, Zophar says in verse number 5 that you better be glad that it's us who is talking and not God who is talking. Because if God speaks to you, Job, it's going to be worse than what we say. You're guilty of sin and you're only getting, verse 6, you're only getting half of what you truly deserve. I mean, I can't even fathom looking at somebody in a 24-hour period who lost every one of his children, who's lost all of his possessions, his houses, his money, who is dying on an ash heap, as so it appears, and saying, what you are getting is not even half of what you deserve to get. You're talking about insensitivity. This young buck, this know-it-all, he's got God figured out. Zophar speaking up. I'll tell you what your problem is, Job. You're a liar. You've brought this all upon yourself. And what's happened to you, that's only half of what you really deserve. He doesn't stop there. He not only says, Job, you're guilty of sin. Here's the second thing he says to Job. Job, you are ignorant about God. Job, you are guilty of sin and you are ignorant about God. Look at verse 7. Canst thou by searching find out God? Canst thou find out the Almighty unto perfection? You know why he's asking this question? Because it was just in the previous chapters that Job says, I'm on a quest. I'm trying to determine the heart of God. I'm trying to discern why he has brought this upon me. And if there is sin that I don't know anything about. Because you remember that verse we talked about last week? Job said, I don't believe any sin has caused this. But God does know me better than I know myself. And perhaps there's something way deep down in my soul that God is judging me for. I want to find that. I want to know it. I want to discern that. And Zophar responds and says, you're crazy. You actually think you can figure out God? Look at verse 8. It is as high as heaven. What canst thou do? Deeper than hell. What canst thou know? The measure thereof is longer than the earth, broader than the sea. If he cut off and shut up or gather together, then who can hinder him? For he knoweth vain men. He seeth wickedness also. Will he not then consider it? In other words, do you actually think, Job, that you can understand God and know all that he is? You see, what Zophar is doing here is he's actually taking the position that he knows about God things that Job will never know. That's what he's saying. You figure God out? Job, why don't you leave that to us? Because obviously we know more about God than you do. And this quest and this search and this desire to figure it out, you're just never going to know that. He's actually posing himself as being smarter about God than Job will ever be. And I just want to suggest to all of us in a practical way that we ought to be careful about people who think that they have all the answers. Especially regarding who God is and what God has to say. Because that's where Zophar is positioning himself. I know what you will never know. I have all the answers. I know things about God you'll never be able to figure out. Job, here's your problem. You're guilty of sin and you're ignorant about God. Third thing he says is you're stubborn like a donkey, Job. You're stubborn like a donkey. That's your problem. You're guilty of sin. You're ignorant. You're stubborn. Look at verse number 12. For vain men would be wise, though man be born like a wild ass's colt. If thou prepare thine heart and stretch out thine hands toward him, if iniquity be in thine hand, put it far away, and let not wickedness dwell in thy tabernacles. For then shalt thou lift up thy face without spot. Yea, thou shalt be steadfast and shalt not fear, because thou shalt forget thy misery. Remember it as waters that pass away, and thine aim shall be clearer than the noonday, and thou shalt shine forth, and so on. I'm not going to read the rest of it, but here's what Zophar is saying. Job, you are as stubborn as an old donkey. What you need to do is just get right with God, repent of your sin, and the Lord is going to remove this misery. And when God removes this misery, Job, you will forget that this has ever happened to you. Just repent. Stop being stubborn. Get right with God. The problem is that Zophar is giving a religious formula. He's giving a 1-2-3 step to solving this suffering in his life. The problem is Job's suffering isn't a result of sin in his life. And he may be saying something that is true. He's saying it to the wrong person in a different situation, and especially in the wrong spirit. Well, when you come to chapter 12, Job answers, and you can tell he's about had enough of Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. I'm actually, in relation to the message this morning, surprised that Araka is not coming out here. You read verse chapter 12, you find out that Job even himself responds a little harshly. Remember, these are believers that are talking to each other. And I think it is sad sometimes how believers communicate to one another. Now, we're sympathetic with Job because, after all, we know all that he's going through. Especially being on the bad end of insensitive friends, we can surely understand why Job responds the way that he does, with his emotions running high. I don't know that there's any of us who would not respond in the way that Job responds in chapter 12, but let's at least see it. Look at verse 1, chapter 12. Job answered and said, "No doubt that ye are people, and wisdom will die with you." You see what he's saying? You guys are the experts. I mean, just listen to you. You are the experts, and when you die, there will be no one else on earth left to tell us how to live. Ever wanted to tell somebody that? You know it all. You got it all figured out, and when you're dead and gone, none of us are going to know what to do. He's being a smart aleck here. He's responding harshly. He's had enough. But look at what he says in verse 3. "But I have understanding as well as you. I'm not inferior to you. Yea, who knoweth not such things as these?" He says, yeah, like you, I also have a brain and can understand what's going on here. Job proceeds to give a series of statements that declare his faith in God, howbeit sometimes very little faith, but faith nonetheless. Three things that Job makes very clear here in the remaining chapter 12 through 14. Chapter 12, here's point number one of what Job says, a statement of faith. You'll see it on the screen there in your notes as well. Number one, my God is sovereign over all. That's what Job says. My God is sovereign over all. Listen to me, one of the most important things you can ever know about God is that he is sovereign. One of the most important things that you can ever know about God is that he is a sovereign God. That is, he is in control of all things. All things. And Job spends the entire chapter, chapter 12, talking about the sovereignty of God. And we pick up in verse number 7, because it's in verse number 7 through 10 that Job says even animals recognize the sovereignty of God. Look at verse 7. He says, "Will you speak wickedly of God and talk deceitfully for him?" Excuse me, I'm in the wrong chapter. Chapter 12, verse 7. He says, but ask now, the beast, and they shall teach thee, and the fowls of the air, and they shall teach thee, or speak to the earth, and it shall teach thee, and the fishes of the sea shall declare it. Who knoweth not in all these that the hand of the Lord hath wrought this, and whose hand is the soul of every living thing and the breath of all mankind? He says, what God has allowed to happen to me, he has allowed because he is sovereign, because he is in control. Ask the animals, ask the fish, ask the birds of the air. They all know that God is in control of all things, and the God who controls them is the God who controls me. The God that has allowed this to happen to me. The sovereignty of God, listen to me tonight. The sovereignty of God is not just something we need to declare theologically. But knowing it theologically allows God to personally minister to us in the midst of what appears to be chaos in the world and derailment in life. What I mean is knowing that God is sovereign in all things not only brings greater appreciation for his grace, it brings me comfort in all circumstances of life. Some of you have a hard time sleeping at night because you watch too much Fox News or CNN or whatever you like to watch. You're going to get to breakfast and lunch together with your buddies. That's the first thing you're going to talk. Did you see this? Did you hear that? We're so consumed with the chaos of the world. We're so consumed with the derailment of life, of what appears to be. And let me tell you something. I went to bed last night at 8 o'clock. And I slept until I had to get up this morning. And I slept like a baby and I snored as loud as I could possibly snore. Because regardless of what's going on out there, God is in control. I'm going to lose sleep over that. Am I concerned? Sure. But it's not our job as Christians to be political heroes, to fix the chaos. No, this is all God's doing. We live the gospel. We preach the gospel. And we know that everything that happens, even in the White House, God allowed it to happen. He is in control. And you'll sleep a whole lot better tonight if you go to bed realizing, hey, no matter what happens out there, God is in control of it, and I don't have anything to be afraid of. That's what Job is saying. I'm dealing with this because I know that my God is sovereign over all. And he points out the sovereignty of God in various areas. In verse 15 of chapter 12, he talks about the sovereignty of God in nature. Look at it. Verse 15, behold, he withholdeth the waters and they dry up. Also, he sendeth them out and they overturn the earth. What's he saying? God is in control of nature. God is in control of nature. I'm still teaching my children this. Have not yet to appreciate the fact that God is the one who sends the rain and the snow. And so we got out of the car today as we were walking from the car to the restaurant with Brother Bax. You know, we have a guest pastor and we want them to dress well and be well and speak well. And the first thing my son says when he gets out of the car without his umbrella is, this stupid rain. This stupid rain. Daddy, this rain is stupid. Keegan, God sent us that rain. God sent us that rain. Listen, we're all guilty at times at being a little bitter toward the things that God has orchestrated. I often wonder as a pastor, why when it snows in North Carolina, the two times it always snows in North Carolina, it's either on a Sunday or a Wednesday. Never snows on a Thursday or Friday. Never. But it's always, and those stupid meteorologists, they'll say on Monday, we might have snow this weekend, and half of you have already said, I'm going to stay home. You find ourselves getting a little upset at even the things that God has orchestrated. Like he's the one responsible for droughts. And he's the one responsible for floods. Job says, God is in control of all things. He's in control of nature. Look at verse 17. He says, Job says, God's in control of people. Verse 7, he leadeth counselors away spoiled. He maketh the judges fools. He looseth the bond of kings. He girdeth their loins with a girdle. He leadeth princes away spoiled and overthroweth the mighty. He removeth away the speech of the trusty and taketh away the understanding of the aged. He poureth contempt upon the princes. He weakeneth the strength of the mighty. God is in control over people. Throughout the Bible, it tells us that it is the Lord who turneth the hearts of kings and princes. God is doing this. God is allowing this. He's getting to a point here. He's saying, listen, my God is in control of nature. My God is in control of people. Verse 23, my God is even in control of all the nations. Look at it. Verse 23, he increaseth the nations. That means he gives nations prosperity and he destroyeth them. That is, he allows nations to go through difficult experiences. He enlargeth the nations. He straighteneth them again. He taketh away the heart of the chief of the people of the earth. And he causeth them to wander in the wilderness where there is no way. Well, we've seen that already, haven't we? Sure, it's God who made them wander in the wilderness, the children of Israel. It's God who sends nations. He says in verse 12, they grope in the dark without the light, and he maketh them to stagger like drunken men. Who is allowing this? God. Because my God is sovereign over all. He is in control of nature. He is in control of nations. He is in control of you. You see, this declaration by Job was imperative in his quest for peace during this painful experience. And it must be at the heart of all we come to understand about God. That he is a sovereign God. And that he is in control of all things. And no matter what phone call you've received this month or the one you may get tomorrow, God is allowing it. God has permitted it. God has even orchestrated it at times. So while they're picking him apart, Zophar, Bildad, Eliphaz, while they're spiritually ripping his face off, he says, there's something you need to know about God that I do know that maybe you need to be reminded of. That my God is sovereign over all. He is in control of all things, and he has allowed this to happen to me. It's a high moment for Job. Here's the next thing that he says, and that's in chapter 13. The next thing he says is this. Number two, not only is my God sovereign over all, but number two, I will trust my God no matter what. I will trust my God no matter what. Now, once again here, Job lashes out in a little bit of a personal way towards Zophar and the rest of these quote-unquote friends. Look at what he says in verses 1 and 2. Chapter 13, verse 1 and 2. Lo, mine eye hath seen all of this. Mine ear hath heard and understood. What ye know, the same do I know also. He says what he said in chapter 12. I am not inferior unto you. I know just as much as you guys know. I heard what you said. I know what you're telling me. I'm not inferior to you. Quit treating me like I'm different, like I'm less, like I'm more insignificant. I know as much about God as you know about God. Look at verse 4. He gets a little stronger here. Let me tell you about who you are, Job says. You are forgers of lies. You are all physicians of no value. You know what that means? That means you're experts at nothing. That's what he's telling them. You're an expert at nothing. You are doctors of no value. And in that bold statement, he goes a little step further. Look at verse 5. Oh, that you would altogether hold your peace, and it would be your wisdom. In other words, if you really had wisdom, you'd keep your mouth shut. You know, like, the more you talk, the less you say. He's about had enough. In fact, go down to verse 13. Hold your peace. Let me alone that I may speak and let come on me what will. In other words, how about you guys keeping quiet long enough for me to actually deal with this? You're talking so much I can't think. I can't even focus. It would really help me out if you would just zip it. Because the quieter you are, the smarter you are. Now we come to one of the greatest statements of faith in all the Bible. And no doubt a strong moment for Job. Look at verse 15. Though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. Even if God kills me, I will go to the grave trusting him. I will trust my God no matter what happens to me. As you've been reading along with me, and we continue this journey through Job, it is a vicious cycle. In fact, we're going to go through three different cycles where Eliphaz speaks, Job answers. Bildad speaks, Job answers. Zophar speaks, Job answers. And as soon as Job's done here next Sunday night, guess who speaks up again? Eliphaz, hey, I got more to say. And then he's going to say it, and Bildad's going to say it, Zophar's going to say it. And then when you think it's done, Eliphaz says, oh, one more thing. In closing, I'd like to mention this, you know. It's just this vicious cycle. And through all of it, even in these chapters, as we said last Sunday, Job has these high moments like you and I have where we're saying, though he slay me, yet will I trust him. And then a few verses later, he's having those low moments where he's saying, why was I even born? It's a reminder of the Christian life for us, those up and down moments, those high valleys, the high mountains, low valleys, strong moments of faith, weak moments of doubt. At least acknowledge his faith in this moment. In the midst of all of this criticism and antagonistic spirit by his friends, he boldly says, no matter what happens to me, no matter what God allows, even if he kills me, I will still trust and follow my God. I think what you see here is Job becoming utterly dependent upon God. And I think that's what God has to do sometimes. Sometimes in life, he strips us of everything but himself. Isn't that Job? My children gone. Everything I had to my name gone. My health gone. He's learning what it means to trust God, which is why he can say, even if he kills me, I can trust him. Listen to me very carefully. When you get to the point in your life that you are utterly dependent upon God, then you are finally at the place where you can discover how dependable he truly is. And sometimes that's what it takes. That when we get to the point where we are utterly dependent upon God, it's at that point we discover just how dependable he is. Job says, my God is sovereign over all. I will trust him no matter what. Here's the third thing he says. As we come to chapter 14, he says, I will hope in the God of life. I will hope in the God of life. Now, as we come to chapter 14, Job begins looking at life, especially the brevity of it. Look at verse number 1. Job 14, verse 1. Man that is born of a woman. That's just a way of saying everybody, all right? Because everybody's born of a woman, all right? If you're alive and breathing, some of you might need to pinch yourself to determine whether or not that's still true. If you're alive and breathing, you were born of a woman, all right? He's saying everybody, all of us, notice what he says, is a few days and full of trouble. All of us. We have too few days and too many troubles. Too few days and too many troubles. It's a reminder of something we've said many, many times. That we are either in trouble, we're either coming out of trouble, or we're either going into trouble. That's not just me talking about your children. That's all of us. We're either in it, we're either coming out of it, we're either going into it. Why? Because there's too few days and too many troubles. He even says in verse 2, he cometh forth, that is man. Man cometh forth like a flower and is cut down. He fleeth also as a shadow that continueth not. In other words, life is like a flower that's cut down. Life is like a shadow that disappears. And you don't have to live very long to acknowledge all of this. That it's here today and gone tomorrow. And it's interesting how we often look at life, you know. When I was a junior age kid, I couldn't wait to be a teenager, you know. Because the teenagers were older, way older. And then when you're a teenager, you look at the 20-year-olds, and they're really older. I can't wait till I get to that age. They're really older. And then the 20-year-olds think the 30-year-olds are really older. And the 30-year-olds think the 40-year-olds are really older. And you know where I'm going. You 70-year-olds say, I'm still young. It's the 80s that are really, really older, you know. It's that life, you know. Life is brief. And all this talk about the brevity of life is calls Job to think about the finality of death. Look at verse number 7 of chapter 14. He says, for there is hope of a tree, if it be cut down, that it will sprout again, and that the tender branch thereof will not cease. Go down to verse number 10. But man dieth and wasteth away. Yea, man giveth up the ghost, and where is he? Job is grappling, if you will, with the finality of death. That there's hope for a tree that's been cut down, that it will grow and live again, but is there hope for me? That when I give up the ghost, when I die, is that it? Is that all? Or will I continue to live? That's what he asked in verse 14. If a man die, shall he live again? By the way, that is the ultimate question of life. If a man die, will he live again? This is a normal thought process, especially for those who are dealing with the reality of their own soon departure from life. And it's not a matter of if I die. He's not saying if it's possible for man to never die. No, he's saying when I die, will I live again? And that very thought that Job raises here is the question that proves that God has put within all of us a desire to keep on living. That's why we fight for life. That's why we struggle with death. Because we want to keep on living. And that's why when we get sick, we go for treatments, for help. That's why we get put in the hospital. Is there more you can do? I understand as Christians that we have the hope of eternal life. I understand that we're one with Jesus in eternal life, heaven. And it's like my dad used to say, look, I want to go to heaven. I'm not sure I want to go today. Isn't that the reality? Sure it is. Because God has put this desire in the hearts of every one of us to keep on living. And the answer to that question is both a person and a promise. What question? Well, the question he asked. When a man dies, will he live again? Well, the answer is a person and the answer is a promise. And what is that person? And What is that promise? Well, Jesus said, I am the resurrection and the life. He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. When I die, will I keep on living? If you're trusting the resurrection and the life, if you're following Jesus, and Job understands this, he understands that. His faith in God is strong enough to realize that though it appears death is soon to take him, that in reality he's not going to die. Look at the rest of verse 14. He poses the question, if a man dies, shall he live again? But notice what he says, all the days of my appointed time will I wait. Now notice this phrase, this is good. Till my change come. What change? The change from this life to the next. He's not saying I'm going to wait till the appointed time that my end will come. No, I will wait for the appointed time that my change will come. And that's the promise of the New Testament. That we will all be changed in that moment. In that moment that God brings us from this life to the next. It's not the end for a believer. It's only a change. A change. And this is the expression of hope. Job is choosing to hope in the reality that no matter what happens in this life, as a believer in God, he knows he will never truly die. And that's why, as difficult as losing those we love in this earth is, for a believer, there is peace in death. Sure, we want to keep on living, but we have that promise that we will keep on living. No soul sleep. There's no temporary assignment. No, the Bible says to be absent from this body is to be present with the Lord. When you take your last breath here, the very next moment you'll take your first breath there. You keep on living. You don't really die. You don't really die. And Job said, I'm going to hope in that because it feels like I'm getting ready to die. And though he kill me, yet will I trust in him. For my hope is in the God of life. I put this sermon together 2 weeks ago. Before Billy passed, and it's so fascinating that in my notes 2 weeks ago, I had this quote from Billy Graham. Someday you will read or hear that Billy Graham is dead. Don't you believe a word of it. I shall be more alive than I am now. I will have just changed my address. I will have gone into the presence of God. Isn't that what Job is saying? When my appointed time comes, I'm just changing addresses. That's when my change will come. This is Job's resolve. It's his resolve in the face of insensitive, uncaring friends. Job is saying, say what you want about me, my supposed sin, and the judgment of God on my life, but my God is sovereign over all, and I will trust him no matter what, and I will put my hope in the God who gives life eternal. What powerful words. Though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. And I think those things need to be stored up in our hearts because we don't know what's going to happen from one day to the next. And I think that's what is most apparent in the life of Job as it relates to our very lives today. You wake up one morning, he's out on the front porch sipping his either Starbucks or Dunkin' Donuts. I can't quite make it out in the Hebrews. But he was brewing something, drinking that coffee, enjoying the cattle, Perhaps a dinner had been planned that night for all the sons and daughters to come over. I like that. One messenger after another. From the moment the sun came up to the moment the sun went down, the thing he feared the most had happened. But though it had happened, still, Job was resolved to trust in him. I don't know what's going to happen to us this week. None of us can ever know what phone call we're going to receive, what one doctor's visit will be like. But we can resolve in this very moment that no matter what happens to me tomorrow or next month or next year, that even though he kill me, I will go to my grave trusting in him. And it's one thing to preach. It's another thing to live. And I don't need God's help preaching it. I need God's help living it. And that's what we need to pray. God, help me, that though you kill me, I'll still trust in you.